Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did life as a war correspondent shape the career of the venerable journalist Walter Cronkite? Americans would come to know and deeply trust Cronkite in his role as longtime anchor for CBS News, but he actually earned the attention and respect of his colleagues years before as a 20-something wire service employee sent abroad to report on World War II for newspapers all over America. Cronkite was also a newlywed at the time, and among the greatest hardships of his stint overseas was his separation from his beloved wife. Betsy Cronkite, for her part, meticulously saved the detailed letters her husband sent her throughout the war, and they form a fascinating picture of Cronkite's early life as a journalist and a source of bonus commentary on the events and the people he was writing about professionally. Morris Isserman is professor of history at Hamilton College. His new book is called Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. It was written with the journalist's grandson, Walter Cronkite IV. Morris, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be here.
So this story starts, I guess, initially for you, with you looking at your class rolls a few years ago and noticing an unusual name.
Yeah, there was Walter Cronkite, and I thought that this was a writing class, no less, a freshman writing class, and I thought that the registrar was pulling my leg, but the Hamilton College registrar doesn't do that, and indeed it was the grandson of Walter Cronkite, the anchorman of CBS News. And so we got to know each other, Hamilton being a small place. I got to meet his parents, including his father, Chip, or Walter III, and they approached me a couple years ago with these letters that they'd stumbled across in the University of Texas archives.
What sort of journalism career had Walter Cronkite had between leaving his degree unfinished, we should say, at UT, where the archive now exists, and heading overseas for the UP?
Well, he had nothing to do with television, of course, which barely existed, or even with radio. He was a print journalist. He worked for a number of newspapers, and then he was hired on by the wire service, United Press, mainly based in the Midwest, did a stint in Texas, but mostly around Kansas City. When the war broke out, that's where he was.
So Cronkite was eager to do the work overseas, but there was this huge sacrifice involved. He had to leave behind his wife, and by all accounts, those two were crazy about each other.
Yeah, it was really a marriage made in heaven. And, of course, they were still newlyweds. They had begun dating in 1936, but they were only married in the spring of 1940. And so when Cronkite moved to New York City in the spring of 1942, Betsy came with him, but he was at the same time angling for a war correspondent job overseas, which is where reputations were being made. The title of our book, Cronkite's War, really is a double meaning, because there was the war that he was sent to cover, but there was also the war that was going on within himself, because here he was covering the greatest story of his generation, making his name as a journalist, seeing, you know, exciting things he couldn't have imagined seeing just a couple of years earlier in Kansas City, but all the time longing for Betsy and recording that longing in these 100 or so letters that have been preserved from the war.
And, of course, those letters contain all the usual expected sort of sentiments of love and details of domestic affairs. But it's worth pointing out that Betsy had a journalism background herself, so these also read like letters to a colleague in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, she was a journalist. She was employed during the war in Kansas City as such. Walter, like many men sent overseas, wanted to leave a record behind of his experience. He wasn't a diary keeper, but the letters function as a kind of a diary of his wartime experience. That and a kind of travelogue, because, of course, neither of them had traveled abroad before the war. People didn't really do that much in the 1930s. He was introducing her to scenes in London and then on the continent in Paris and Amsterdam that he was seeing, but she could only imagine.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Morris, when you say that they hadn't traveled much before the war. Cronkite is essentially learning how to be a war correspondent while acting as a war correspondent.
Absolutely. And he's also a kind of classic innocent abroad. Mm-hmm. In the first week in London, he leaves his wallet in his trench coat, which he hangs up when he goes into a restaurant and comes back. And lo and behold, you don't do that in a big city. It wasn't all sacrifice in wartime comradeship in London in those days. There were pickpockets around. He had to learn that lesson the hard way. Mm-hmm. So he's gaining the sophistication that will serve him well in his later career.
He did hate English food.
He hated the food. He lost an incredible 40 pounds in the 2.5 years that he and Betsy were separated. She comments on that in one of the few letters we have from her. He complained bitterly about the English habit of serving Brussels sprouts with everything, for example. And he fantasized about finding a good American steak, which in wartime London wasn't really possible. In fact, he talked so much about food that we had to take some of it out. I mean, we couldn't put in every complaint about food. I was thinking for a while we should title the book The Walter Cronkite Wartime Austerity Diet. Our publisher didn't think that was a good idea.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, a guy in his mid-20s still has quite an appetite, and he's working all the time. And conditions in London, it wasn't always horrible, but lots of people were sort of going without during that time, especially as the war dragged on.
Right, and he'll write to Betsy about he can't get his favorite pipe tobacco, and he can't, you know, find it. Socks or underwear, and she sends over little care packages for him, trying to provide the things that were still available in the United States during the war, but the English hadn't seen for quite a while.
So how was the UP Bureau set up in London, and how was the decision made to base him there instead of elsewhere?
Well, all of the wire services and the major newspapers were trying to get their reporters overseas and vastly expanding their operations. So Cronkite was part of a large expatriate community of American reporters, and a lot of his letters to Betsy are, you know, detailing the social lives that these men, mostly men, live. There were some female correspondents over there as well. Many of the people who were sent over were already or were about to become famous in journalism. For example, the bureau chief for the United Press in London was Harrison Salisbury. Harrison Salisbury, after the war, would become a reporter for the New York Times, and he would win a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage from Moscow during the 1950s. Later, he wrote about Vietnam. Edward R. Murrow, of course, was there and was already a journalistic star as a broadcaster for CBS Radio. So Cronkite, who again had been a kind of obscure second-string reporter for the United Press in the Midwest, is all of a sudden in a very heady atmosphere.
It's an interesting difference, it seems, in terms of how objective they were expected to be with regard to the activities of the Americans and the Allies versus the enemy. Kind of a different feel then?
Definitely. There was no such thing as adversarial journalism, as it came to be called in the Vietnam era. The reporters thought of themselves as part of the war effort. United Press took out advertisements, we reproduce one in the book, showing reporters kind of storming the beaches with American soldiers landing on some enemy shore. And that's how they thought of themselves. I mean, they were going to tell the truth. They weren't going to make stuff up. They were going to report losses. But they did so in a tone that took for granted that this was a worthy effort, that the war should be supported, and that victory was inevitable. Hmm. They were very much team players, in a sense.
And in fact, Cronkite on a number of occasions was, I guess the only word really for it, is embedded with U.S. troops on various missions, some of which turned out to be just incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, they were definitely embedded. One of the things that's striking is we reproduce a number of wartime photographs of Cronkite, and he's in uniform. Correspondents wore uniforms. This was the first war in which that was the case. And Cronkite accompanied combat troops in various ways. He, for a civilian, he risked his life numerous times, starting in February of 1943 when he flew in a B-17 bomber on what was only the second American air raid by the 8th Air Force based in England on a German target. They attacked a German submarine base at Wilhelmshaven in northern Germany. And on that raid, there were six bombers shot down, and one of Cronkite's colleagues, Bob Post, the reporter from the New York Times, lost his life. His bomber was shot down, and no one was able to parachute out. On a subsequent occasion, he would fly on several more bombing missions, but in Operation Market Garden, the airborne invasion of Holland in September of 1944, made famous by A Bridge Too Far and also depicted in the Band of Brothers series, Cronkite landed on the first day of the attack in a glider, which crash-landed behind enemy lines. And for the next 12 days, he was under German artillery fire. He was caught in the German bombing raid on Eindhoven, which is depicted in Band of Brothers. And when he came out from it and wrote a letter to Betsy, his first letter he was able to write, she knew he was there just from his dispatches, which were appearing on the American newspapers. But he said, you know, I never want to be under fire again. It was a terrifying experience. And yet, a couple months later in the Battle of Bulge, there he'd be covering that and was again at the front line.
How was he able to get those dispatches out from the front or from behind enemy lines?
Well, they would use radio communication to get out short dispatches.
Mm-hmm. And there was also the thing that's really interesting about Cronkite is that he seems to be very courageous in a way that is easy to identify with. He didn't say, I wasn't afraid at all. He wasn't sort of this swashbuckling figure.
No, and he was very modest about it, both during the war and afterwards. And he said, you know, I was no hero. The real heroes were the ones who did that kind of thing day after day. He became very close with a number of the pilots and bombardiers and navigators in the 8th Air Force, but he saw them die in droves. To be in the 8th Air Force in 1943, which is before those big lumbering bombers had adequate fighter protection, was to be almost guaranteed to be a casualty. Three-fourths of the air crew in the 8th Air Force in 1943, before they completed their 25 missions, which was what was required of them, three-quarters of them would either be killed or wounded or shot down and captured, which meant they were prisoners of war for the duration of the war. And these were, you know, Cronkite called them the boys. He was 26 himself. These were young men, 21, 22 years old. In fact, Cronkite advised Harrison Salisbury, his bureau chief, not to get to know the pilots that well because they weren't going to be around that long.
Morris Isserman is my guest. He's professor of history at Hamilton College and co-author of the new book, Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Hamilton College Professor of History Morris Isserman, who is co-author, along with Walter Cronkite IV, of the new book Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Morris, there were a number of Christmases that Cronkite spent away from his home and family, and these seem to have devastated him. Sometimes he was thinking about this like 6 months out from Christmas.
Right. And his grandson said that even later in life, when of course he knew his grandfather and lived near him in New York City and spent summers with him in Martha's Vineyard, that Cronkite had a real sentimental streak about holidays, particularly Christmas, and would go to elaborate lengths to, you know, make it the most magical kind of family event possible. So here he is in London, and he has his, you know, little flat and a roommate and no Christmas tree, and Betsy sends him a Christmas card and Christmas presents, and he kind of lovingly tells her about opening them up and how much he appreciated them and how he wished he could be around the tree with her and their beloved Cocker Spaniel, Judy, who he writes about a lot.
Yeah, a lot about Judy, actually.
A lot about Judy. It took me a while to figure out who this redhead was.
Judy the redhead.
Other than his wife. And it turned out it was the dog, who was very much the surrogate child,
yeah,
for the then childless Cronkite family. So, yes, he was very sentimental about Christmas, about Valentine's Day. He noted all the holidays, even Halloween. He sent her a naughty limerick on Halloween that they were apart.
You know, you mentioned Judy, and Judy was sort of the surrogate child, as is the case for so many couples before they have children. And it was very relatable, I think, when he, toward the end of the war, Cronkite is writing to Betsy, really lamenting that they've had to put off starting their family. Nowadays, it wouldn't be strange at all, but in those days, you know, late 20s, if you were married, of course you had a family.
Absolutely. I think Betsy was even a few months older than Walter was. So it was unusual. And he writes a letter at one point saying, you know, he really wants to get even with Hitler. This is a very personal war, he says, because Hitler and the Nazis have kept him and Betsy apart for so long. My wife read some of these letters at one point and said, why don't you write letters like this to me? Well, who writes letters, first of all, anymore? But they're really very touching sentimental mm-hmm. love letters, as well as a chronicle of men at war.
What doesn't remain, I guess there might be a couple of examples, but there are very few of Betsy's letters to Walter. And I'm assuming that's because he was moving from apartment to apartment and he had to sort of travel light.
Right. And again, there was the kind of foreign correspondent aspect of it, the wartime diary. And probably neither he nor Betsy at the time thought that her letters were as consequential because she was home in Kansas City. I mean, as a historian and kind of a biographer of wartime Cronkite, I wish he had decided otherwise. It would have mm-hmm. been fascinating to see the interplay between the letters. We can kind of read into his letters some of what Betsy is saying, and there are points where he is offering apologies for things. He feels guilty that, you know, maybe he's writing too much official news and not sending enough personal news along. So you get a feel for what the conversation must have been like even without Betsy's letters there.
Morris, we know that today when certainly soldiers but also war correspondents go abroad, they will avoid telling their families certain things just to keep them from worrying. Did you sense that Cronkite did that in his letters to Betsy at all?
Oh, absolutely. He told her about being scared in combat, but he didn't provide all that many details. There was also wartime censorship, and there was every letter that he sent home was going to be read by a military censor. So it's kind of amazing that the letters are as intimate as they are. One of the things he couldn't tell her about his bombing mission in February 1943 over Germany was that he was actually firing a 50 caliber machine gun from the plexiglass nose of the B-17. There was no room for a non-combatant on a bombing mission, but of course it was a violation of the Geneva Accords for a civilian to be playing a combat role. Later, when he talked about that mission, he said he didn't think he hit anything, but he was literally an embedded correspondent, because when they got back to England, he was up to his waist in spent 50 caliber machine gun shells. Had to kind of pull himself out of that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Austin in Dallas. Hi, Austin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Hey, this is a great show. I really enjoyed listening to it. I have a question. Back in college, I had the honor of taking a class on warfare in the modern world with a guy who had been a captain in the Corps, and he had mentioned, as a matter of fact, that when the first pictures of the Battle of Iwo Jima came home, a lot of people wanted to throw in the towel after seeing the reality of, you know, people's sons floating in the water. And I was curious, to what extent did journalists, I haven't been able to dig it, but I couldn't find anything on that in my own research, but he, you know, spoke from fact. And I was curious if our author here could tell us a little bit about self-censorship and the role of self-censorship combined with honesty and also that kind of gung-ho war effort.
You mean self-censorship to the extent that they wouldn't report upsetting or details that made it appear as if the U.S. was not triumphant?
Well, I guess the issue there was, you know, it was weird to see, you know, when you look at today versus the news back then, and that was one of the first times that they had, like, real pictures of dead Americans in the media.
Yeah, well, what can you tell us about that, Morris?
No, that's a very good point. I think the first photograph of a dead American soldier didn't appear until 1943, and it was about an assault on a Pacific island. And there were official guidelines. There was an official Office of War Information that oversaw what correspondents wrote and what American publications reprinted. But the caller's absolutely right. It was almost unnecessary, because people like Cronkite were not going to report news, or at least not report the news in a way that they felt would undermine the war effort. So they talked about sacrifices. Cronkite wrote some very moving pieces about pilots he knew who didn't come back, about the weeping crewmen, members who helped unload the bodies from the B-17s when they landed at these air bases in England. But he did it in a way in which those deaths were meaningful. They were redemptive. It wasn't an unnecessary sacrifice. So even if you saw an image of a body, or if somebody like Cronkite wrote about those deaths, it was delivered in a way that would contribute to civilian morale rather than undermine it. So there was censorship, and there was definitely self-censorship involved.
An email here from Mick asks what role Cronkite's World War II experience played in his later opinions of the Vietnam War, which influenced public opinion against that war.
Very good question. And some of the senior commanders in Vietnam, for example, Creighton Abrams, who replaced William Westmoreland as American commander, had been young officers in World War II in Europe, and Cronkite had known them. He'd known Creighton Abrams as a young officer in Patton's Third Army at the Battle of the Bulge. And Abrams spoke very frankly when Cronkite made his famous trip to South Vietnam after the Tet Offensive in February of 1968, Abrams spoke very frankly to Cronkite about the situation in Vietnam. So Cronkite, by that point, he was not a beginner in this business. He felt he had more of a basis for taking a critical stance. He had gone into the war, like most Americans, as a supporter. He believed the press releases, that the light was at the end of the tunnel and so forth. But it was speaking to officers he knew and also speaking to the younger CBS correspondents who were on the ground in South Vietnam that began to turn him around, so that by 1967 and the beginning of 68, he was already taking a more kind of skeptical view of the war that the results of the Tet Offensive confirmed for him.
It's really interesting that Cronkite was aware from very early on that one thing his American readers really hungered for was stories of their, at the time they would have called them boys, overseas. So the first thing he would ask anybody he met was, where are you from? What's your hometown?
Right. Those were called in the wire service hometowners. You mm-hmm. wanted to have these portraits. And, of course, it helped get the stories picked up, which was what the United Press wanted, by if there was a reference to a Dallas boy in the 8th Air Force. Be sure that story would be prominently featured in the Dallas newspapers and so forth.
How did Cronkite and his editors make decisions about where he would go within the European war theater and what he would cover?
Well, his initial assignment was to cover the air war, and mm-hmm. of course that was the big story through 1943 because Americans weren't fighting on the continent yet. They were fighting in North Africa, and then in mid-43 in Italy. But the real focus was on the invasion. This was all everybody began to talk about the big day coming, and Cronkite wanted to be there for the invasion. He wanted to shift the focus of his reporting from the air war to the coming ground war in Western Europe, the opening of the Second Front. He was very disappointed when it was some of his colleagues who were sent in with the landing craft. He actually went on another bombing mission over the invasion beaches on June 6, 1944, but it was so cloudy, all he caught were a couple of glimpses through the clouds of the invasion armada steaming towards Normandy. And then through the summer of 1944, he made a few trips across the channel, but he kept waiting to go with the airborne. There were, before Market Garden, there were two or three aborted missions that the 101st Airborne and the 82nd Airborne were going to land outside of Paris, and he was all psyched to do that. He hinted in his letters to Betsy that a big story was coming up in August, and he didn't get to do that. So it's only in September that he finally gets to cover the story that he's been hoping for more than a year, to be on the ground in Europe with the advanced elements of the American war against the Nazis.
Even when he was in London, that was, of course, a city under siege. What kind of reporting did he do about the effects of air bombing campaigns on the city of London?
He didn't write so much about that in his dispatches because he was, again, focused on the air war itself. But he certainly wrote about it to Betsy. Mm-hmm. And one of the most memorable letters describes the day in July of 1944. The invasion had already happened, but he was still there in London, when a Nazi buzz bomb, a V-1 rocket bomb, smashed into the building next to his building, his flat in central London, blew in all the windows. He, as soon as he heard the bomb overhead, he hit the floor, which is what you were supposed to do, and he survived the blast. But in the next building, which was actually a barracks, there were 150 killed. So he was at the front even when he wasn't at the front lines.
He took pains to let Betsy know that although some of his colleagues were carousing, including his roommate, who was kind of a wild guy, that he wasn't overdoing it.
Yeah, well, this was a hard-drinking generation, and journalists had a reputation for being especially hard-drinking. Cronkite's father had gone off to war in the First World War and come back as an alcoholic, and his parents were divorced sometime after that. So I think he wanted to reassure Betsy that this wasn't going to happen to him, and he would typically say, well, I got there and everybody was, his euphemism was a bit organized, meaning they'd had quite a bit to drink. And as usual, Cronkite was, you know, two or three drinks behind everybody else. But that was a lot of what their social life was like. And also, this being a city full of single men and married men who were leaving their wives behind, there was a whole lot of extramarital sex going on, including Harrison Salisbury would write frankly about his own affairs. He divorced his wife after the war and later remarried. And Cronkite was at some not pains to establish that he wasn't having an affair, because I think Betsy took that for granted. It's pretty obvious that he wasn't having an affair because he kept trying to bring Betsy over. He wanted her to get a job with United Press or hope that the Kansas City Star would bring her over. But he wrote about some of his colleagues' extramarital affairs back to her.
I guess the fact that he was writing about them was another reassurance, because he just wouldn't bring it up had he been messing around.
I would think that's the case.
Yeah, and there were times when, you know, you mentioned that he would write about things he needed, even things like, you know, clothing. He needed, like, socks and underwear and shirts that after a while were just not to be had in either in the post exchange or just on the street in London.
Right. I mean, he was a slender guy to begin with, and he lost 40 pounds, and the clothes he brought over were hanging on him and looked like a scarecrow. And then we have, again, the photographs from family scrapbooks that we reprint, and the guy looks like he needs some new clothes and a good American meal with some meat on his bones.
Yeah, he writes that all his suits look like they were made for his dad.
Right, and his dad was a hefty guy by that time.
Yeah. How were Cronkite's relations with, like, his roommate, they seem to have been, like, the two least likely people to live together for a number of months and years?
Yeah, Jim McGlinsey, was later a colleague at CBS, had a serious drinking problem and tended to get kind of aggressive when he'd had too much to drink, and got Cronkite thrown out of, the two of them thrown out of their flat because he kept picking fights. McGlinsey kept picking fights with guys bigger than himself down in the hotel bar on the first floor. But Cronkite had a kind of protective side to his nature, and this odd couple maintained their apartment through the time that Cronkite was in London up through 1944, after which he was based on the continent. I think that friendship was stabilizing for Cronkite. I mean, he felt a bit adrift, and it was nice to have one person, even if it wasn't Betsy, that he could keep house with.
Morris Isserman is my guest. He's professor of history at Hamilton College and author of the new book, Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Morris Isserman. He's professor of history at Hamilton College and co-author, along with Walter Cronkite IV, of Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Morris, we have talked about the fact that Walter Cronkite began to make a name for himself in journalism, a national and international reputation during World War II. What would you say it is about his writing that distinguishes him from some of his peers that did not go on to such great heights?
Well, he learned the virtues of wire service reporting, which was you had to be fast, you had to be accurate, and you had to be direct. It was a kind of colorful writing. You really learned how to pull the reader in, to hook the reader in the first paragraph. And some of those qualities he carried over into broadcast journalism. He wrote his own scripts. He wasn't just reading lines when he was a CBS anchorman. And he had that real kind of competitive edge, which you weren't necessarily aware of. You know, when I watched Walter Cronkite as a teenager and then into my 20s. So, you know, I watched him from 1963. I remember him reporting on the Kennedy assassination and all the way down to 1981 when he retired and reporting on Ronald Reagan's inauguration. He was this kind of avuncular figure, Uncle Walter. I almost felt like I had a family relationship with him myself.
Yeah.
But beneath that, there was this hard-driving reporter, very competitive, and these letters reveal that. I mean, he's always crowing to Betsy about scooping some of his colleagues from the rival wire service, from the Associated Press or from the big newspapers, and get that story out first and get the facts and be the best out there.
And he was noticed by Edward R. Murrow during the war, but at that time had no interest in moving into broadcasting.
Yeah, and it was a source of some tension between them afterwards. Murrow offered him a position with CBS Radio, very prestigious, and a lot of the Murrow boys, as they were called, went on to distinguished careers in radio and then in television journalism. And Cronkite considered making the jump, but instead he went back to his boss at United Press and said, look, CBS is trying to recruit me, and he wheedled a bigger raise at it. I think he was the best paid United Press correspondent in London during the war. And so Murrow, who was not used to people saying no to him when he was offering them this plum, carried some resentment about that, although later on they were, of course, colleagues at CBS television.
Yeah, I guess the idea that how could anybody turn down the likes of Edward R. Murrow?
Yeah.
Were there things about Cronkite? I mean, did he have to? Was there a certain hot-headedness that you think? You know, you mentioned he had this avuncular presence later on that many people who remember him recall very well. Was he still sort of working out the demons of being a young man in a very challenging profession at this time?
Well, I wouldn't say hot-headedness. I mean, he seems very even-keeled. One of the things that people who know him well, like Bob Schieffer, said at his memorial service was that the Cronkite you saw on television was not that different than the Cronkite you'd meet on the street. Mm. Schieffer talked about walking down the street in New York City, and people would come up and say, you know, I saw the story on television this evening. I was really struck by what you said about blah, blah, blah. And Cronkite was always open and engaging, and he was genuinely interested in the news. I mean, he was fascinated by world events and world figures. So to that extent, from the beginning, he was who he was. But at the same time, there's this ambition. I mean, we, most of us, know Cronkite from the moment when he was already a national figure, an icon, a constant presence in our living rooms every evening at 6:30. But what's interesting to see him in 1942 and 43 and 44 is that man in the making. When he's driving himself to become the best he can at this profession and to make the most of this opportunity provided by the war.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Kim in Dallas. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I was intrigued by something that the author said Walter did in referring to the cities and trying to tell the stories of the different soldiers in order to make it more relevant. And the reason I'm intrigued by that is it occurs to me that's what Homer did in the Iliad.
Hmm. Uh-huh. That's an interesting comparison.
Go ahead, Morris.
I mean, our first embedded journalist was Homer, although he actually wasn't there, but he certainly passed on the stories and created a living and memorable tale of war. I think that's what Cronkite is doing. I mean, he's not naming the Achaeans and, you know, how many ships they brought, but he is saying, you know, from little towns and big cities, rural hamlets across the country, our boys are going off to face the reality of war. It was a kind of Homeric mission.
How were Walter and Betsy finally reunited?
Well, after, again, scheming for 2 years, 28 months to bring her to London, he finally gets a leave in March of 1945 and goes home and meets her first in Kansas City, and then they go to New York. And, of course, we don't have any letters from that period, but thankfully Walter was now famous enough that a society columnist, a woman's page columnist from the Kansas City Star, interviewed Betsy about her few weeks she got to spend with her now famous war correspondent husband, and she talked about going to New York and the restaurants they'd gone to and the shows they'd seen. They went to see Oklahoma, and how she was trying to fatten up Walter to get back on some of those 40 pounds he lost and so forth. So we do have a record of their, I'm sure, very joyous reunion. But then by the end of April, he's back in Europe, and it's not until September that she is able to book passage. The war is now over, and joins him first in London, and then they go to Paris, and then they go to Brussels, where he is now bureau chief for the Low Country in Europe, based in Belgium. And she will accompany him then to Nuremberg in the spring of 1946, where Cronkite covers the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi war criminals. And then they will move to Moscow later that year, where he is bureau chief for United Press in the Soviet capital for 2 years, until Betsy becomes pregnant with her first child and they decide that's the moment they're going to return to the United States.
And at that point, I would imagine he could write his own ticket and work wherever he wanted to.
Pretty much. He began to do radio work and then moved to CBS Radio by 1950. And this brand new broadcast medium, television, was beginning to become more widespread. At that point, there was no CBS Evening News as such, but the station in Washington, D.C., which is where Cronkite was based, invited him on as a guest. This was the start of the Korean War. He was thinking he would be going to cover the war for CBS Radio, but he gave a kind of little chalk talk. This was very primitive stage in special effects on television. They put up a blackboard and he with an outline of the Korea on it, and he sort of pointed out where the enemy was and where the Americans were and so forth. And somebody noticed that he had a flair for this kind of thing, and so he became a regular on this first local broadcast, and then he moved to the national broadcast. CBS Evening News through the 50s and into the beginning of the 60s, like that of the other networks, was only 15 minutes long. And it was only in 1963, under Cronkite as anchorman, that the show expanded to a half hour, which is when television journalism came into its glory period.
Were there any puzzles, Morris, looking through these letters, that even with the help of the family and people who knew Cronkite personally, that you weren't able to quite figure out?
There were private jokes that, I talked to all the family members I could, and nobody knew who that was. And, you know, it's just stuff between a husband and a wife. Some of that, if it got too obscure, we cut out. But some of that we left in because it gives the flavor of their relationship, that they would have these kind of inside jokes.
And my understanding is that Betsy Cronkite had quite a sense of humor.
She had a wicked sense of humor. And this is where, it was very useful to collaborate with Walter Cronkite IV, the grandson, because he, could remember that. He remembered that of his grandparents, how they would joke together and how Betsy would, sort of ridicule and bring down her famous husband a peg or two. And the grandson thinks that, that contributed to his essential modesty, that, he might be viewed as this great man by the world outside of his own home, but Betsy was there to remind him that he was, same husband she'd married 30, 40, 50 years earlier.
Had members of the Cronkite family looked very carefully at these letters before they were donated and preserved at the university?
No, they didn't know about them. They were in a box in the back of a closet in the Cronkite's New York City apartment, and Walter had specified that he wanted his papers to go to his alma mater at UT, and so Chip, the son, and Walter IV, the grandson, went down and got their first look. They were the first in the family to see these things. They were pretty much forgotten. I think even Walter Cronkite Jr. didn't quite remember them because he wrote a memoir, and at several points the memoir differs, not in important ways, but in ways that if he'd seen the letters, he would have reminded himself, you know, what actually happened at that moment during the war. So these had been unread for 60-odd years when they were rediscovered.
It must be an interesting process for you as a historian to work with family members who are also discovering these at the same time, because there's a sort of, I would imagine, an extra kind of emotional dimension to the experience.
Absolutely. And it was a good collaboration because I was doing my historian thing, and there's a narrative that sets the letters in context. And so I was talking about the 8th Air Force and the expansion of the American bombing campaign and so forth, which is the necessary but dry component of history. Whereas my collaborator, Walter Cronkite IV, was able to bring the direct personal knowledge of just who this man was, as he saw him as an older man, but he could read back into to the younger man, and also Walter Cronkite IV is now himself a young journalist. He works for CBS in Washington D.C. and he has this very strong, obvious identification with his grandfather, and kind of I think understood what he was going through and what it meant to him to be suddenly handed this greatest story of his generation, the story of the Second World War.
One example of a tiny detail that the younger Cronkite picked up on is when his grandfather writes about his clothes, there's some text in the book about the fact that Cronkite was always kind of a dapper guy, like he cared
Absolutely.
About how he looked.
Right. Grandson, knowing his grandfather, could say who his tailor was, and his grandmother also had that love of clothes and where she shopped and how she liked to present herself, and the jade earrings she wore that set off nicely her red hair and her green eyes. That kind of detail comes through.
And the book does make, I would imagine, everybody who reads it want to go and search around in the attic to see if their families might have similar treasures of a more personal nature.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, one of the joys of being a historian is that these treasures turn up from time to time and offer us a new perspective on a story that we thought we knew well. We thought we knew the story of Walter Cronkite well, but here he is, you know, the young man just coming into his own, an aspect of his life that, at least for me, I had no idea before.
Maurice Isserman is professor of history at Hamilton College. His new book is called Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. It was written with the journalist's grandson, Walter Cronkite IV. Maurice, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.